The waiting began and lasted for 12 long days. And each of those days was filled with ceaseless labor as water was hauled in buckets to the top of the drawbridge gate and poured over the great wooden planks. By night and day, the water cascaded down the gates, and skins of cattle were soaked and spread, only to be retrieved, soaked and spread again. The fire-breathing idol spewed flames from its mouth and nostrils in a never-ending torrent, scorching wood and stone, and heating metal until it glowed with a ruddy cast. The Ningal tore apart the dwellings of the townspeople to fuel the monster at the gates. Into a cavity at the idol's base, they threw the lumber and oil that sent the flames and sparks gushing from its white-hot mouth. On the evening of the 13th day, an officer approached Ronsard timidly.
Lord Ronsard, I...
Yes! Say anything but that we are running out of water!
The man's face went white. His mouth hung slack.
By Asriel, I meant it as a jest! Speak, man!
What is the trouble?
Thedo strode up to relieve Ronsard at his post. He was fresh and rested, eyes alert and tone confident.
I am trying to find out, sir. It seems the news he brings steals his voice.
Well, speak, sir. We are stout enough to hear it.
Lord Rudd has sent me. The water supply is too low. We cannot last the night.
Ronsard needed to hear no more and sent the man away.
That cuts us to the quick. What are we to do now? Wait until our gates crumble away in flame or until we die of thirst? Oh, which should come first, I wonder?
We have our wits about us yet. We have been too slow in comprehending this menace, and that may be our undoing. I have an idea I should have had days ago, but it may work yet. Quickly, send some of your men to bring ropes and grappling hooks. Tell them to hurry, Ronsard, and bring all they can find. There is little time.
Thedo took his place on the barbican, directly over the flame-throwing idol. After soaking a long rope in water, he tied a three-pronged grappling hook onto one end, and leaning as far out over the wall as he dared, held only in Mermior's and Ronsard's steely grasp, he lowered the hook toward the monster. Thedo swung the hook out, and by a chance, it caught on one of the iron beast's fangs.
You men, take this rope and pull it tight!
Thedo readied another rope and hook. In the space of an hour, he had another hook lodged in the idol's horns. The Ningal were now in a maddened frenzy, helpless to prevent what they feared might happen. A fourth rope was secured to the massive war machine.
That should suffice.
Do you think it would work?
We will soon see. I can think of no better course.
Then let us hope this one does not fail.
Ronsald signaled the men holding the ropes, 300 in all, to begin pulling.
Heave, men! Heave!
It is working! You lazy geniuses! It is working! May the gods be praised!
They looked down to see the rope stretched tight as harp strings. The iron idol teetered ever so slightly as the ropes pulled it upward.
I pray those ropes can hold.
They will hold! You shall see! I have a feeling about this. They will hold!
In a few moments, the flaming idol was slowly lifted up off the ground and then began to swing forward toward the gate. This iron image banked into the drawbridge, its snout pressed against the bridge's planks, which began to smolder.
The gates are burning!
I did not foresee that!
Do not turn away now. Stay with your plan.
Yes, a little while longer.
Bring water to the gates!
More water was poured down the outside of the gates to quench the fire that had started. White billows of steam rose with the black smoke of the flames. The idol rose a few more inches and then stopped. Suddenly, the ropes went slack. Everyone dashed to the battlements to see the flaming monster teetering on the edge of the ramp. The ropes had burst under the strain and had dropped the iron image back to the ground, where it had rolled to the edge of the ramp and was in danger of toppling over the edge into the dry moat below. Ningal warriors, half crazed with anger, leapt to the dangling ropes in an attempt to haul it back from the brink. It appeared as if they would succeed. The image righted and stopped rolling with two of its six huge wheels spinning out over the chasm. Hundreds of Ningal were now swarming to the ropes and were tugging it back inch by inch.
Well, we are in for it now, I fear. No better off than before.
It was a good idea, my friend. It almost worked. At least we did not let the monster destroy our gates without a fight.
Look! We are saved!
Ronsard and Thedo turned in time to see 50 men tumbling down the ramp, grasping the end of a falling rope. The snap of the rope caused the lowering statue to lurch violently, teeter once, and then plunge over the edge, dragging 100 men with it, still clinging to the lines. The idol landed on its wicked head and crumpled in a shower of sparks, one arm breaking off and opening a great hole in its chest where flames leapt up and showed those looking down from the battlements that the monster was indeed ruined completely, and many of its wretched keepers as well.
We are saved to fight another day!
Yes, but how many days will we last without water?
The council was held in Escavar's chambers, with the king sitting up in bed, frowning furiously and darting quick questions to his advisors. Though he appeared even more gaunt and pale than ever, his eyes burned intensely, and his hands were steady as he shook his finger in the air.
This is not good. It leaves us no choice but to fight them on the plain. The siege can but kill us one by one as we drop from thirst.
We have a little water left, sir.
How little?
3 days. 4.
So we prolong the agony that much longer? No. I will not see soldiers weakened by thirst attempt to hold off the fall of Ascalon. If Ascalon falls, it must be on the field of battle. If the end is to come, let it come. But let us have our wits about us and let us die with our swords in our hands. We can at least give these barbarians a fight they will long remember. This Nin will live to regret the day he set foot upon the soil of Mentendor, though every one of us perish.
This fiery speech of the king greatly heartened several of the lords in attendance. Rudd, Beniot, and Fincher had grown restive during the siege. Not men of patience, they itched to take up arms and meet the foe in fair contest.
What say the rest?
Thedo stepped forward. All eyes turned toward him.
Sire, what you propose is the last desperate act of desperate men. I do not think we are pressed that far just yet. I say we just wait a few days. Much can happen in that time, and we are safe within these gates. The Ningal have done their worst and have failed. I think we may yet prevail against them if we but wait a little.
The time for waiting is over. It is time now to act. We have waited these many days, and we are no better for it. I am with the king. Let us fight and die like men, since we have no better choice.
I am much inclined to agree with you, Rudd. And when the time comes to stand toe-to-toe with the enemy, you will find me in the foremost rank. But there is good counsel in waiting. 3 or 4 days may mean much. The Lords of the North may yet appear at any time. We would do well to be ready in that event. I say let the time be spent in readying ourselves to fight, but hold off the fighting until we must.
What do you say, Mirmior? Your counsel has been invaluable to us in these last days. Speak, tell us what you would have us do.
I have no counsel to give, my lord. I have said all I thought best, and it has brought us to this extremity. I will speak no more, but rather take my place alongside these men worthy to be called your loyal subjects, and lift my blade with theirs against the hated foe.
Sire, let us not act hastily in this matter. Let us rather withdraw from here for a time and search our hearts before pressing for a decision.
And I say we must not wait! Every day we stand by, our men will grow weaker and our chances worsen. Now is the time to strike!
Noble lords, I will not force you to a decision. Neither will I tax you further with waiting, which can belabor a man's spirit. Therefore, I say that we will ride out tomorrow and engage the enemy. That what little advantage there may be in surprise, we may carry with us. Go now and look to your men. See that they are well fed and made ready. Tomorrow at dusk, I will lead them into battle.
The lords left at once to begin preparing for combat. Thedo and Ronsard lingered and spoke to the king in an effort to change his mind. But he turned a deaf ear to them and sent them away. After they had gone, Queen Alenia came in to spend one last night at the side of her king. Escavar had chosen dusk to lead the attack because reports from his sentries had it that the enemy's watch on the postern gate was reduced at that time while the Ningal took their evening meal. It was a bold move and a clever one. It was to be assumed that an attack by the castle dwellers would issue from the main gate, Here it was that the warlords had positioned their greater strength in anticipation of such a move. The postern gate, being smaller, and the long crooked ramp that led from it being walled and narrow, permitted knights to ride, but three abreast. These things Escobar took into consideration and decided the result was favorable. He would achieve a fair measure of surprise in such a maneuver, and he would catch the Nengal unprepared and in the wrong position to begin a battle. They would mass quickly as the call to arms was given, he knew, but by that time he hoped to have his own men ranged upon the plain and ready, having already dispatched a goodly number of the foe. The Dragon King and his army spent the day preparing and positioning men and horses to move through the postern yards and through the gates as quickly as possible. When all was ready, a hush fell over the wards and yards where the men waited. The sun sank in the west, a great crimson orb, and the wolf star shone fiercely in the east, shedding its cold, harsh light upon all who huddled beneath it. The villagers and peasants gathered to send their champions forth, and to pray to all the gods they knew for the victory. The banner of the Dragon King lofted on its standard and wavered through the crowd as a path opened before it. And then there was the king himself, sitting erect upon a milk-white stallion that pranced in trotting steps toward the gate. Over his silver armor he wore a royal blue coat which had the dragon emblem worked in gold. His helm bore no crest, but the simple gold circlet of his crown. Flanking him on either hand, two grim knights, one astride a black charger, the other riding a sorrel, gazed resolutely ahead. Behind them rode Mirmior, who after the fashion of his own people wore no armor, but carried only a light round shield and a short sword. They passed through the yard to the gate, followed by ranks of nobles and knights, three abreast. When they reached their position, the king raised his hand, and the procession stopped. He looked to the gatekeeper, who, peering down from the barbican, nodded in return. Then Escobar, his face gray and hard, his eyes gleaming cold in the evil light of the star, drew his sword with his right hand. The heavy iron portcullis was raised, and the plank let down over the dry moat.
Charge!
The Nengal were caught unaware. The alarm had not reached them before the knight's fierce attack. In moments, the scene was one of fire and blood, of reeling horses and slashing blades. Many of the Nengal fled from the camp rather than face the fierce justice of the king's swords. And for a fleeting moment, it appeared to the defenders that the Nengal would be overcome and crushed. But too soon, the body of knights surrounding the camp was outflanked by a larger ring of Nengal led by the two other warlords. These began pressing forward, pushing the knights inward, shrinking the diameter of the circle by force of superior numbers. It seemed that no matter how many of the enemy were killed, there were more standing than had been there before. Escobar realized that the position was indefensible. With Thedo on his right and Ronsard on his left, the Dragon King led a withering charge toward a weak section of the circle. The Dragon King's knights, fighting with a strength born of desperation, held the line against the warlord's fearsome bodyguard and reduced that number effectively. The Nengal axemen boiled onto the field like a tempest-driven flood. Though they beat against the armored knights with terrible blows of their cruel axes, the defenders withstood all. At the end of an hour's time, the attack broke off, and the warlords withdrew.
We have made a good account of ourselves. What is more, we have not suffered much loss.
Even one man is too many, brave sir. They propose to wear us down one by one if need be, until there is none left standing.
By Azrael, it is the only way they will take Ascalon. But we are far from defeated yet, and I have a plan that may confound them. Thedo, gather the commanders. I would speak to them before the next attack.
They met on the field, and the king spoke hurriedly, finishing just as the enemy came on again. As the Nengal closed on the defenders for the second time, there was a stirring within the king's army, and the attack met not a solid wall this time, but a rank which gave way before them. The enemy was instantly drawn inside the ring, like water into a flask, and then the stopper was replaced, cutting off the X-Men from their leaders, who were now inside. Warlords Gurd and Bogaz, watching from a distance, soon realized what had happened, and readied a second wave to smash the outer ring of the king's defenses, and thus lay open the battle for a speedy end. Mounted upon their sturdy black steeds, the warlords swept down into the fray. They had nearly reached the field of combat when their attack faltered and broke apart amidst a deadly flight of arrows. The Nimgul fell in such numbers that the warlords pulled up short of engaging the king and swerved to meet the archers who were now running to join their comrades on the plain, having staved off the second wave. The archers, who had been left behind to defend Ascalon in its last need, were led by Mirmior and several of the boldest knights. They had been sent to bring the archers as part of Escalar's plan to divide and confuse the enemy. The charging Nimgul could not draw within blade range of the archers and were at last forced to retreat and regroup.
We have not fared so well this time. We have lost many good men, perhaps too many to withstand another charge.
Withstand we must! We must hold!
We have surprised them twice! I do not think we will again, but we have stood them a battle that will be sung in the halls of brave men everywhere! That is something to take with us.
You have ever shown us courage, my king. Lead us, and we will follow through the gates of death itself.
You have served me well, brave friends. I have trusted you with my life on more occasions than a king ought, but I have never found you wanting. This is how I want to be remembered. Turned out in my finest armor at the head of loyal men and brave, this is how I would enter the rest of my fathers.
Ronsard raised a hand to protest, but Escobar waved him silent.
Enough of dying. Now to arms, for the enemy once more draws near.
Across the broken battlefield, now slippery with the blood of the dead and dying, the Nimgul advanced, slowly this time, behind a vanguard of horsemen with flaming pikes. The four warlords had positioned themselves so as to command a phalanx of troops ahead and behind them. This time, there would be no force held in reserve, and there would be no tricks, for they moved over the plain step by step, wary of the slightest shift among the soldiers of the Dragon King. The baleful Wolfstar burned down upon the scene with its hateful light, bright as noonday sun, casting shadows all around. It seemed to grow larger, to fill the sky, making the forlorn moon rising in the east a pale and insignificant thing. Escobar turned his face to the Wolfstar.
Surely that is an evil thing. I feel its fire in my bones. What burns, Ronsard, they don't you feel it?
It is the heat of battle I feel, sire.
Aye, that too.
The king seemed to come once more to himself and looked out across the battlefield, now rolling in the smoke and the fiery pikes of the Nimgul.
They think us slow-witted enough to wait here like cattle for the slaughter. They are mistaken.
Thedo, guessing the end was near, looked across to his friend Ronsard and offered a wordless salute. This was the long dark road he had seen so long ago. Now that it stretched before him, he did not fear it, though it saddened him. He wanted to speak some final word to his friend, but none would come. The salute said all.
Farewell, brave friends.
Ronsard closed the visor of his helm and raised the point of his sword toward Thedo.
For Metzendor!
The army of the Dragon King leapt as one into furious motion. The shock of the clash as the charging knights met the stubborn Nimgul shook the earth. Escobar's white stallion could be seen dashing straight away into the thick of the fighting. Ronsard, bold and bright, defended his king's left with a tireless arm. Thedo guarded the king's right and strove to keep himself between his lord and the bloodthirsty axes of the barbarian horde. By the time the sickly moon had advanced 2 hours' time, the army of the Dragon King had for the first time taken the upper hand in the battle. The warlords were fighting a defensive action, seeking a retreat whereby they could regroup their lagging regiments. But Escobar and his commanders, though suffering from fatigue and the terrible attrition of their numbers, doggedly struggled on to put the invaders to flight. At midnight, an entire Nimgal regiment broke and ran from the field.
We can seize the day. The barbarians have lost the heart to win.
Sire, let us pursue them and drive them from the field. But you remain here where your soldiers can see you. Gather your strength.
Yes, my lord. Let your commanders earn some glory. Do not endanger yourself further. Rest a little and regain your strength.
I will rest when the day has been saved and not before. If my knights wish to see me, they must look towards the heart of battle, for that is where I will be. Battle!
The two trusted knights had no choice but to surge after him and protect him however they could. For a moment, it appeared as if his final assault would indeed shatter the Nimgul strength, for the howling axemen of the warlords melted before the defenders' blades as snow before the flame. And for a moment, the Dragon King and his knights stood unchallenged on the hard-won battleground as the enemy roiled in retreat. But the illusion of victory was fleeting. The sound seemed to come tearing out of the ground as if the very earth were rending. Those who heard it quailed in its presence. Even the stoutest among them trembled. All eyes turned toward the south, and for the briefest instant the rolling smoke parted to reveal a solid wall of warriors stretching across the plain. Nin the Immortal had arrived with his 50,000. The battle-weary defenders watched in horror as the conquest so nearly won raced away on wings of hopelessness, and certain doom swarmed in to take its place. The Nimgul, seeing their sure salvation, halted their retreat and turned once more upon the Dragon King's battered army. At once, the hapless defenders were surrounded on every side and cut off from any possible retreat. The warlords urged their warriors to fighting frenzy, and one by one, the Dragon King's brave soldiers fell. Ronsard and Fado fought to keep abreast of the king and protect him to the very end. But a sudden rush of enemies swirled up before them and drove them apart. Three black-braided howling Nimgul, their mouths foaming, eyes wild, and faces smeared with blood, leapt up and grabbed the reins of Fado's mount. One of the attackers instantly lost a hand in a crimson gush. Another dropped dead to the earth. The third smashed his axe into Fado's chest. Fado reeled in the saddle, falling back beneath the force of the blow, which would have killed most men. The Nimgul attacker, still clutching the haft of his axe, was pulled off the ground as Thedo's courser reared. Thedo swung his buckler down upon the enemy's head. By some miracle, Thedo remained in the saddle and wrenched the axe from the crease in his chest plate. He knew himself to be grievously wounded, but turned to look for Ronsard and Escobar. He saw Ronsard engaging four or five enemy with flaming pikes and swords, trying to keep them from reaching the king, when suddenly a warlord charging into their midst with his black cape flying struck into the fight. Instantly, the warlord was met by the lightly armored figure of Mirmior. The seneschal, his face a mask of hate, thrust himself between the king and the warlord. Fado saw Mirmior's sword flash in the starlight in a shining arc. The warlord raised his blade, and Mirmior's sword shattered with the force of his mighty blow. The warlord struck against Mirmior's shield. Fado watched helpless as the warlord's cruel and curving blade flicked out and buried itself deep in Mirmior's unprotected chest. Even as the warlord sought to withdraw the blade, Mirmior clutched at it with one hand and pulled, jerking the battle lord forward in the saddle. In the same instant, Mirmior brought his broken sword up and slammed it into the warlord's throat. So quickly did this happen that Fado had scarcely lifted the reins to send his mount forward, and it was over. From his vantage point, Fado saw Ronsard, who had killed three of his assailants, lurch away and drive once more to the king's side. But in that momentary lapse, worlds were lost. For Fado, already pounding to his aid, saw Escalar pulled from the saddle to sink into a boiling knot of Nimgal with pikes and axes. Ronsard first reached the spot where his monarch went down. Fado's arrival sent the rest darting away, as Ronsard, heedless of his own safety, flung himself from the saddle and knelt beside his king. Defenders swarmed to the king's side, forming a wall around the body of their beloved ruler. Ronsard held Escavar's head in his hands and carefully removed the king's helmet.
It is over, brave friend. I shall lift my blade no more.
Say not so, sire!
Ronsard tore off his gauntlet and thrust a corner of the king's cloak into a bleeding wound at the base of Escavar's neck.
There is no pain. No pain. Where is my sword?
Here, sire.
Fado placed his own weapon into the king's grasping hands. Escavar clutched the weapon to his breast and closed his eyes. Those watching from the castle ramparts and battlements saw the king fall.
Look to the east!
All eyes turned their gaze eastward, where the forlorn watcher saw a strange and wondrous sight. It appeared to those watching and to the soldiers crouching over the body of the Dragon King that lightning flashed out of the east with the brightness of the blazing sun. For there was a sudden blinding flare which seemed to fill the sky, outshining even the light of the Wolf Star. Another burst of brilliant light struck the sky, and the surging Nimgal paused to look up from their bloody work to view with alarm this new marvel. Suddenly, all anyone could see was the form of a knight on a white steed bolting out of the east. In his upraised arm, he carried a sword that blazed and flashed with living light.
Jalakir!
Jalakir burned with the brilliance of a thousand suns, throwing off bolts of lightning that seared the air. For the Nimgal, transfixed by the unearthly vision, this was too much. Unafraid of bold earthly warriors, they were terrified at the appearance of this heavenly foe. The barbarians threw down their weapons and fled before him. Quentin drove into the center of the reeling horde. He drove straight toward Nim the Destroyer and his 50,000 panic-stricken warriors. Jalakir flashed in his hand. Quentin raised himself in the saddle and flung the sword skyward. The sword spun in the air, and it seemed that as it reached the apex of its arc, it suddenly exploded and showered tongues of fire all around. Quentin felt the fire rush through him. Though the lightning danced blinding waves around him, he opened his eyes and saw the darkness roll away, revealing a city splendid and beautiful, shimmering in the light as if carved of fine gold and gems. The exquisite sight brought Quentin to his knees. He threw his hands before his face to blot out the vision, and the tears came rising up as from a spring. In that moment, he felt in his inmost soul the hand of the Most High God upon him. When Quentin raised his head, he was alone, and the night was dark. The Wolf Star had disappeared in a great flash. Some said that the Shining One had reached up into the sky and smote the star and extinguished it, for it vanished in the same instant that Quentin had thrown the sword. Jalakir had fallen to earth and was found buried to the hilt in the obscene body of the immortal Nin. The conqueror of kings lay dead, pinned to the ground like a serpent. His unhappy minions, witnessing the swift miracle of their cruel lord's death, fled over the plain. They sought to escape the justice that would soon overtake them. Quentin returned to the place where Escavar lay. Together with Fado and Ronsard and the lords and knights of Mensendor, he picked up the body of the king, and lifting it upon his shoulders, bore it away to Ascalon. The funeral of the Dragon King lasted 3 days, and his mourning continued for 30. During this time, Wertwin and the armies of Amaronis, Lupolin, and the others arrived, greatly saddened and contrite, for news of the king's death had overtaken them on the way. They were sent in pursuit of the Ningal, who were fleeing back along the Arvin toward the sea, where their ship still waited. The Lord slew many of the enemy in their flight, and the rest were driven into the sea at Lance Point. Escavar's body was taken at once to the castle, where it was placed upon his own bed. Durwin, aided by Bjorkis, came to minister to the body, washing it and composing it for entombment. Inchkeith worked long hours over the king's armor, pounding out the dents inflicted upon it in the last battle, and shining it bright as new. Queen Alenia herself dressed her husband in his finest garments. Bria and Esme adorned him with his most treasured jewels. And then he was taken to the great hall, where he was solemnly laid upon his bier. The king's body lay in the great hall for 2 days, guarded by a sorrowful contingent of knights and nobles throughout the day and night, while a steady procession of tearful subjects filed past the litter. The afflicted citizens roamed the streets of the town, inconsolable in their grief. The great Dragon King had passed. No one had ever thought to see that dark day. Quentin remained in his chamber and would see no one. He did not even venture to the battlements to watch the funeral pyres of all the brave dead of the king's proud army as they burned upon the plain. He held himself to blame for the king's death, reasoning that if he had arrived but a few heartbeats sooner, Escobar would still be alive. Only Tolly was allowed in to serve his master. But Quentin's needs were few, for he would neither eat nor sleep, but sat slumped in a chair before the darkened, empty hearth. At midnight on the second day, Quentin bestirred himself and crept quietly to the great hall. The mourners had gone, and no one lingered in the hall except the 10 knights, standing as statues of stone around the body. Torches burned on standards at the 4 corners of the bier, casting a soft, hazy light over the pall. Quentin moved close, mounting the flower-strewn platform, to kneel beside the body. In the lambent glow, the king's features were relaxed and calm. Except for the unnatural stillness, he might have been asleep. Gone were the traces of the illness which had so wasted his noble frame. Gone, too, were the lines of care and concern which had creased his visage of late. The years seemed to have been rolled away, and Quentin saw a younger Escobar than he had known. His hair was dark and swept back over his temples. The high forehead was smooth, the nose straight and well-formed, above a firm but not ungentle mouth. The hard jut of the jaw had been softened, revealing a man at peace within himself, and the deeply cleft chin spoke of the unflinching purpose of the man who had been. The king wore his armor and held his helm, nestled under his left arm. His sword lay upon his chest, where it was held at the hilt in his right hand. The writhing dragon device on the king's breastplate seemed to twist and wink in the firelight. A cloak of royal blue, edged in silver and gold, was fastened at the throat by a golden chain and the king's favorite dragon brooch. Escobar appeared ready to leap to his feet and ride once more to the trumpet's call. Quentin bowed his head, and hot tears fell upon the bier. He recalled so vividly the time when he had seen his king just so, held in the evil Nimrud spell. Then, by an impossible miracle, the necromancer's enchantment had been broken, and the Dragon King free to live again. But it was a far more powerful sorcery that embraced the king now, one that claimed all men in the end, and from which there was no release. Quentin felt a light touch on his shoulder. He glanced up to see Queen Alenia, dressed all in sable, looking down on him, her green eyes deep pools of sorrow, but shining more beautifully for the compassion with which he regarded him.
I have sought you these past 2 days, my son. You must not blame yourself, for in the end he chose his own course, as he ever did. It was his wish to die serving the kingdom he loved. And of all his loves, this one, his love for his realm, claimed his highest devotion. He was a king first, and a man only second.
Thank you for your words, m'lady. They do soothe me well. I will not blame myself, though I did at first. I know now that this course was set for him long ago. He would not bend to another.
Not and remain Escavar for long. Look at him, Quentin. See how peacefully he slumbers. Death held no terror for him. He had conquered it many times. The thing he feared and hated most was that his realm would fall before him, and he would not be able to save it. That gnawed at him. It poisoned his last days. But he conquered that too, in the end.
How well you knew him, Alenia.
Knew him? Perhaps I knew him as well as anyone could. And I loved him with all my heart. He loved me too, in his way. But a king does not belong to himself, or to his family. He belongs to his kingdom. Escavar felt this more intimately than any I have known. He died for Mensador, as he lived for it. But there was much that even I did not know of him. The long years of war, years away from his home, took more than time away from us. Many was the night I cried out in loneliness for my husband, and would have had a strong hand to hold my own, but there was none. Escavar was away, fighting for his kingdom. Even when he returned, he never rested. He was always turning his eyes here and there, searching every remote corner of Mensador for any sign of weakness or trouble. He once told me, by way of apology, I think, "If you seek to know me, know first my kingdom." He was Mensador. Its life was his.
Quentin looked upon the dead monarch, realizing there was much he would never know of the man who had adopted him to be his own.
Now that he is dead, what will happen to his realm?
It shall live on in the life of the new Dragon King.
Alenia bent over her husband's body and removed the dragon brooch and chain. She then turned and drew Quentin to his feet.
You will find this to be far heavier than the weight of its gold, my dear one. But he wanted you to have it, and all that goes with it.
Quentin shook his head slowly, fingering the golden brooch which the queen had fastened on his cloak.
I was never his son. As much as I love you both and am grateful for your kindness to me these many years, I am not fit to be the king.
Who would be better?
His true-born son, perhaps?
You know he had no male heir. But I shall tell you something. I have always thought it strange that a man who valued his throne so highly would have...
Given it away so freely?
No. He did not give it away at all, Quentin. You see, Bria was born just before Escavar went to war with Goliath. When he learned that I could have no other children and his one offspring was female, I expected him to be angry. I offered to relinquish my crown so that he could take another, but he would not hear of it. He said he was content, that he would trust whatever god that ruled him to provide an heir when the time came. He never spoke of it again. So when he chose you to be his ward, I knew he had found his heir. How he knew, I cannot say. But he saw something in you that pleased him very much.
It seemed a kingly whim to me, m'lady. Not that I was not overjoyed to receive his high favor. But as much as I loved him and Ascalon, Dekra is my home. He must have known that.
It did not matter. He wanted for you only your happiness. He knew that when the time came, you would fulfill his hopes and expectations. So deep was his trust.
I hope he was not mistaken. I pray he was not.
Alenia looked upon the still form of the king and turned away at last, offering Quentin her hand.
He was not mistaken, my son. All is as it should be, as he would have had it. You will see.
The next morning, the body of the king was taken to the Ring of the Kings, the ancestral resting place of the Mensendorian monarchs, established within the green walls of Pelgrin Forest. The funeral cortege, made up of knights and nobles on horseback and loyal subjects on foot, wound through the hastily cleared streets of Ascalon. Townspeople stood among the ashes of their ruined city to pay a last farewell to their sovereign. Quentin rode on Blazer next to Alenia, and directly behind the funeral bier. Bria and Derwin followed, and were in turn followed by Thedo and Ronsard, who led the procession of noblemen. Others came on in turn, riding beneath their colorful devices and banners. At the head of the cortege, the Dragon King's own standard carried his red dragon, hung with pennons of black. The king rode to his tomb on his bier beneath a sky of radiant blue, sown with tufts of white clouds. A cool wind freshened the summer air and bore sorrow far away, though here and there a tear still sparkled in an eye. The sun shone down upon the body of Escobar fair and full, and the wind ruffled his hair as his armor glinted hard and bright in the sun. Escobar was placed in one of the beehive-shaped barrows within the ring, the very barrow Quentin had found him in years before to rescue him from Nimrud's fell scheme. The barrow was clean and well-ordered, having been swept and appointed by Oswald, the Queen's Chamberlain. With much ceremony and dignity, Escobar was laid to rest upon his stone slab, which had been spread with fur coverlets from his bed. His most highly prized possessions were placed about him, and when all had looked their last upon the king, the tomb was sealed and the entrance filled in with earth. Quentin assisted in this work rather than stand by and watch, and when it was over, he turned away and did not look back. As the funeral party emerged from the green silence of the Ring of the Kings, they were met by a party of lords, led by Wertwin. The noblemen bowed in their saddles and gazed down at Quentin, who still walked beside the queen, holding her arm.
We are told that you are to be the king's choice to succeed his throne.
I am.
We mean to offer you our fealty. He who wields the Shining One is our king.
The surrounding lords all nodded their agreement. From somewhere nearby, Tolly appeared, bearing a sword in his arms. Quentin smiled at his servant and took the sword. He felt the quick warmth of its grip as it touched his fingers. Then, suddenly, the forest glade was awash in a brilliant light as Quentin lofted the sword for all to see.
May the god whose power burns in this blade burn in me as well. I will accept your fealty.
Thedo and Ronsard shouldered their way to his side and clapped him on the back. And then Quentin was borne away on the shoulders of his loyal subjects. A jubilant parade returned to Ascalon, in marked contrast to the one that had issued from those gates earlier in the day. Although the official period of mourning would continue for many more days, from that moment, the healing process throughout the ravaged land was begun. In Escobar, all the dead were buried, and the old order laid to rest. In Quentin, the new order was present. With a promise bright as the future which shone like the light of the Shining One at his side. A new age had dawned, and a new king had been chosen to lead the way. And of all those who reveled in it and welcomed it, only Derwin, the faithful hermit of Pelgrim Forest, knew it for what it was. The Priest King had come at last. The promise of the ages had been fulfilled.
The Dragon King Trilogy, The Warlords of Nin Part 2, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2007, Stephen Lawhead. Published by arrangement with Thomas Nelson Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011 by The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. With performances by Thomas Keegan, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Joe Brack, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Lily Beacon, Karen Novak, Elizabeth Jernigan, James Konacek, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, Johan Detweiler, and Michael John Casey. Adapted and directed by Johan Detweiler. Produced by Richard Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Warlords of Nin, be sure to look for R.A. Salvatore's Demon War Saga and Brent Week's Night Angel Trilogy. Available now in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for exciting previews of other graphic audio material.
What's up?
I've got a case. I need you, Danny.
She pushed the file toward me. There were homicide Lay's photos. Gods above, when was this?
4 months ago. Look past the body.
My eyes moved over the picture. A pile of something wrinkled laid off to one side. Is that what I think? Oh, don't tell me it is.
The fucker flayed her.
Remember! Remember!
I don't want to remember Rigger Hall. I have done very well for years without remembering.
Welcome to the House of Pain.
Have a nice night.
It is extremely unlikely.
Rigger Hall. I swore I'd never go back.
Dante Valentine, Book 2, Dead Man Rising, Part 1, is available now in graphic audio.
Remember Rigger Hall.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knights, Vampire Earth.
Gate codes! Is that what you want? There's a spare back door key!
I don't want access to Weathercut. I wanted you out of it, Franklin.
But I'm nobody important. I don't even have my own room.
That's the problem with being a nobody important. Somebody might decide you're disposable. Kind of like that teenage girl back in Arkansas. The one you, Bernardo Gutierrez, Tom Cray, and Sergeant Heath Hopkins raped and then killed.
No! I mean, you got the wrong guy!
No!
What kind of op is this?
We're clearing this housing complex. D-O-E-R.
Of what?
Destruction of enemy resources. You can't stand to actually see a doer?
Enemy resources? You mean the population?
Without a population to feed on, the Kurians pull out.
No objections, I hope.
Objections? Hell yes! For starters...
Hop off your high horse, Valentine. Clearing operations work. Your old man invented him, after all.
He's hot. Sir, is he entering up as a bear?
No. I simply opened the channels. He shouldn't have the biological resource... Wait... Design, help us, I forgot. Oh me, your father was a bear, I believe.
I think so.
You may have had the talent passed down to you.
We better isolate.
Oh, and he needs calm now more than anything. Oh me, I've been a fool, careless. I expect he'll go mad.
You, at the other end, talk, or I make your puppet into a corn dog. Stop it!
What do you want?
Are you Seattle? The head honcho?
No, I am but a keeper.
I want to talk to your chief. king. Grand and exalted overlord, whatever he calls himself. The one in the big tower. Tell him I have an offer.
What could a human give such as he?
Adler, the leader of the resistance.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.